Okay, Daniel chapter 3. Now we're continuing on in our study of the prophetic program, starting with the book of Daniel. We've worked our way up to Daniel chapter 3. And let's look at verse 1. Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold, whose height was 60 cubits, and the breadth thereof 6 cubits. He set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. We've looked at these first few verses here already, and we've seen that it's significant that chapter 2 or chapter 3 with Nebuchadnezzar's image that he sets up follows immediately chapter 2 with the image that God gave him. And we've looked at how Nebuchadnezzar's kind of setting things up in his own image with an everlasting kingdom and, you know, the idol worship and all that stuff that takes place. So we won't dwell any further on that, but you see a lot of things in this passage. You see the moral character of the times of the Gentiles. Chapters 1 through 6 are typical of that anyway. And here in chapter 3 especially, you see that character come out in the idol-worshipping nature of the Gentiles. And we looked at that last time too and saw how just by nature we are idol-worshippers. And even today, being so-called enlightened, that we don't maybe bow down to idols, we set up other idols in our heart. Covetousness is idolatry, the Bible says. So we have different forms of idols today, things that we put in place of God in our lives. Maybe not perhaps like the Gentiles did in time past. Although even in this town here in California, you have people who are worshiping images and bowing down to them. We have a restaurant right in town where people have offered the food to idols before you eat it. And they, you know, do the incense and the prayer and all that stuff, and then they serve you. So that stuff is still going on today, but even today all Gentiles by nature are idolatrous. Whether it's idols or idols that we set up in our heart through covetousness and love of money and that kind of stuff. Verse 2, when Nebuchadnezzar the king sent to gather together the princes, the governors and the captains, the judges, the treasurers, the counselors, the sheriffs, and all the rulers of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image which Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Then the princes, the governors and captains, the judges, the treasurers, the counselors, the sheriffs, and all the rulers of the provinces were gathered together under the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up, and they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And we've looked already and seen how that this is typical of the Antichrist and exactly what he's going to do. Even in verse 4 there you see, then an herald cried aloud to you, it is commanded, O people, nations, and languages. You go over there to Revelations and look at when the Antichrist sets up the image, and you see some very startling parallels between Nebuchadnezzar here and the Antichrist, and even going back to the Tower of Babel. And we've looked at that idolatrous system, so we won't look at it again today. What I want to get into today is what I promised you last week about studying about music. It's very important, not just to us, but also to God. And it's God that created music, and we're going to look at some things about music today. Let's look at verse 5. That at what time you hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, dulcimer, and all kinds of music, ye fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king hath set up. And whoso falleth not down and worshipeth shall the same hour be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. It's a one-world government, and he's going to make it a one-world religion, just like the Antichrist is going to do over there. And he has an image that the whole world is going to be required to worship. Basically, what you have here is a religious dedication ceremony that uses an idol, and music as an aid to worship. I don't know if you ever thought about that in this passage. Here you have a religious ceremony, and it's a dedication of an image that everybody in the government is required to appear, and they do. It's very, very ingenious the way that Nebuchadnezzar does this, and this is perhaps where you see a tactic that government always uses start in the Bible. If not here, certainly back at the Tower of Babel. When the government wants the little guy, the man on the street, the common guy, to swallow a tough pill, the way that he does it is he gets everybody in the governmental positions involved, and then the little guy has nobody to go to, no way to fight it. Like they say, you can't fight City Hall. Why can't you fight City Hall? Because City Hall is united. So here he has everybody, and we've looked at this already, just a little bit of review here. He looks at everybody from the top down. He's got the princes that are in charge of those provinces out there. He's got the sheriffs out there, the law enforcement's there, the lawyers are there. He's got the religious crowd there, the counselors and that are there. He's got the military there through the captains and the princes as well. The governors there as well are military positions, you might say. So he has everybody in the government, every facet of government. The money people are there, the financiers, so that the treasurers and that, so that there is no place for the little guy to go, and the entire government is involved at it. So when the little man starts saying, "Hey, wait a minute, what are you doing?" and wants to fight against what's going on, he has nobody to complain to. We've seen it in the military all the time when they want a difficult thing to be passed down to the troops. It started from the top, and it was established at the top, and then it worked its way down. So that when the troop on the bottom complained, then the senior guy that he talks to is going to say, "Hey, I don't like it either, but I had to do it, and so do you." So there's kind of that intensified pressure of the world system placed on the masses to bring this thing about. But it's a religious dedication ceremony, and music is a very powerful spiritual thing, and it's instrumental here in this setting up of this image and dedicating this image. Let's talk about the musical instruments. To start off with, some of them are very vague what they could be, but you have by the way, you remember we talked about these instruments here while we're talking about them. You remember that one of the things that the scholars use to try to discredit the Book of Daniel is that there are Greek words that are in Daniel that they say should not be able to appear for many, many years, and we know that that's not. We know that that's not true because we found out that, 1,000 years before Babylon, the Grecians and everybody had trade and intermingled with everybody. So there would be Greek words in the language, and especially in this situation here. It may surprise you to know that the Greek words, after going through this huge list that they started out with of about 11, I think it was 11, it might have been 16, somewhere in there. After looking at all those words and hashing them out, they finally figured out that there's really only three. And out of those, one is questionable, so they only point to two. And it might surprise you that the three Greek words that they're talking about are three of these instruments. Isn't that pretty sad? I mean, I don't know about you, but when you learn about an instrument, you usually call the instrument what you're taught to call it. And if it's a foreign instrument, what would you call it? You would call it by its foreign name. We wouldn't call a guitar a harp today. We call it a guitar because the guys who invented guitars call them guitars. So that's what we call them. But here you have the musical instruments. You got the cornet, which is basically a horn. Then you have the flute, which is a pipe that you pass wind through. And it has holes in it that create pitches. Basically, with all the holes open, you create one pitch, and then there are other holes in the pipe too. Yeah, thingamajig. There are other holes in the pipe that create the desired pitches that you want in order to play the proper notes at the proper pitches. A flute. Not necessarily what we would call a flute, but a piping instrument nonetheless. Then there's the harp. Now, this harp here is one of those Greek words. It's said to be a lyre or a dulcimer type of instrument. Some things that they're not really sure about. Then there's a sackbut, which is another Aramaic word. They're not sure about that one either. It could be a lyre, or they call it a sackbut because they don't have a better word for the name. The root word needs to fold it together, so it's could be a lot of things. Then another Greek word that's found in here is the psaltery. Comes from the Greek word psalterion. Basically what it is a 10-stringed harp or lyre. Then there's the dulcimer. There's the third Greek word that you find in the text. And the dulcimer is not what we would call a dulcimer, but the dulcimer is like a bagpipe kind of instrument, a dual-piped bagpipe kind of instrument. Basically what you have when you talk about all of the instruments that are there is you have the different sections of music. There you have the brass, the woodwinds, and the strings. See, you have kind of like an orchestra here. And then he says, you look at verse 5 there. He doesn't just say the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and dulcimer, but then he also says all kinds of music. Now, that's kind of a strange term, but you start studying it out in the Bible, and you find out some interesting things. When you talk about all kinds of music, you look at the root word. The root word is the idea of striking your fingers against a musical instrument. But when it talks about striking the fingers against a musical instrument, it's something that's accompanied by voice. So putting two and two together, you kind of get the idea that not only is the orchestra there, but there's also a choir that's singing with the orchestra. So what you really have is you have a religious service like you might find down the street at the First Baptist Church or the Catholic Church or anything else in their religion with their worship service. And you know how important music is to a lot of people. A lot of people would not even go without the music. But here they have the all kinds of music is set up with those religious instruments. So you have the idea of an orchestra with its own choir to go with it. And they're commanded to fall down and worship when they hear the music. So the music is definitely an aid to the worship service, to the dedication of the image. Just like it's used as an aid in most churches out there. And what we need to do now is we need to look at music, because this is a big passage right here, and music is involved in the religious system in this passage, and we've studied all just about all the facets that we could of the religious system except the music. And I left that for this passage on purpose in order to do it here where it fits in. And so I want to look at music, and in looking at the music, what I want to look at is the origin of music, music's origin. Then we're going to look at music's purpose, the reason why music was created. Then we're going to look at the next thing, the next offshoot out of that is the corruption of music, music's corruption. Then we're going to look at music's restoration, when God is going to restore music to its original purpose. And then the last thing that we'll look at is the actual physical makeup of music to understand how music is put together and how it's made up and how it should be made up correctly to have that purpose take place in your life. Let's start out with music's origin. Go back to the book of Job in chapter 38. Job's a great book when you want to learn about things about the creation. It's said to be the earliest book in our Bible, and it has a huge amount of creation information about it. So if you want to know things about creation, especially those last couple chapters, real good. Job is the book that tells you that a man has his own fingerprints that are individual from everybody else's. The book of Job is the one that tells you that the snowflake, when it falls down, is individual and that there are no other ones like it. And I mean, man's tried to prove that false for so long and just ended up piling evidence upon evidence that it's true. A lot of things about it. Look at Job 38. Let's start in verse 1. Basically, God here has gotten tired of listening to Job falsely charge him. So God's going to confront Job. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, there's that whirlwind. Remember, we talked about God's presence and how he comes, and he comes from the north, and that whirlwind goes with him, and you know the fire that's unfolding, and the glory, and the cherubim, and all that stuff. So here you have God come down to Job and out of the whirlwind and said, who is this that darkeneth counsel by words without knowledge? Gird up now thy loins like a man, for I will demand of thee, and answer thou me. Where wast thou when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare, if thou hast understanding. Who hath laid the measures thereof, if thou knowest? Or who hath stretched the line upon it? Whereupon are the foundations thereof fastened? Or who laid the cornerstone thereof? I mean, he's hitting Job here. You know, who is the guy that I sent out to measure it? You know, who is the guy that laid the cornerstone? Who is the guy that laid the line upon it? You know, making sure it's right and the measurements and everything are there. What is it hanging on? I mean, man's wrestled with that question for a long time. What does the earth hang on? So you have, you know, Atlas holding up the earth, and well, what's Atlas standing on? So then you have Atlas standing on the turtle or whatever it is. You know, I don't even remember anymore, but, you know, man doesn't understand what the earth is hanging on, and here you got God rebuking Job. But watch the next verse. When the morning stars sang together, and all the sons of God shouted for joy. And we've talked about the sons of God and the morning stars and that. And what you're talking about there is the angelic host, the angelic creation. Here the angels are, and God is talking about a time where He is creating the earth. And as He is doing this thing, measuring it out, stretching out the line, laying the cornerstone, the foundations and all that, the angels are singing. There's no men yet. And here you have the angels up there singing. So obviously song and music was around for a while before we were. And it's something that came in, at least the very earliest recording of it that we know about happens at creation. So maybe it's a part of something that God started when He instituted the creation. But looking at the mind of God through the scripture, understanding music, I think not. I think music is something that was inside of God, or is inside of God, and has been forever. Not only is music here, and the sons of God, the angel creation here is singing when He lays the foundation of the earth, but the music is actually built into part of the creation. Look at Ezekiel. Ezekiel chapter 28. The two big chapters about Lucifer, Satan, is Ezekiel 28 and Isaiah 14. And Ezekiel 28 gives you a little bit of information about him physically and what he was like. Ezekiel 28. Let's look at verse 11. Moreover, the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Son of man, take up a lamentation upon the king of Tyrus, and say unto him, Thus saith the Lord God, Thou sealest up the sum, full of wisdom, and perfect in beauty. Thou hast been in Eden, the garden of God. You think about that passage. Obviously, God is not talking to the physical man who's the king of Tyrus on the earth, is he? He's looking at the king behind the man that's the king of Tyrus. Because there were only a few people in the garden, weren't there? Remember who they were? God was there, because God walked with Adam in the cool of the day, remember? Adam was there. Eve was there. And who else was there? Satan was. In the garden. We're talking about inside the garden now. The gods were outside. The garden, there were only four that were ever there. And Satan was one of them. So here you have him talking about Satan and rebuking him as the real power behind the king of Tyrus. Verse 13. Thou hast been in Eden, the garden of God. Every precious stone was thy covering. The sardius, topaz, and the diamond, the beryl, the onyx, and the jasper, the sapphire, the emerald, and the carbuncle, and gold. The workmanship of thy tabrets and of thy pipes was created in thee in the day that thou wast created. When God built, he was Lucifer at this time, when God built Lucifer, he built him with all of these precious stones. And not just with the precious stones, but he built him with tabrets and pipes. Now a tabret, you know what a tabret is, it's a drum. Pipes would be like an organ, like the flute we were talking about. They would be woodwinds kind of instruments, probably an organ. But when he was built with those drums. In other words, it was God's plan, and he intended to create Satan in that way. It's not something that he added later on, but it was the purpose, one of the purposes for which he was created. The other purpose you see in his makeup being covered with all the gems and stones. Let's go on. Verse 14. Thou art the anointed cherub that covereth, and I have set thee so. Thou wast upon the holy mountain of God. Thou hast walked up and down in the midst of the stones of fire. And what that passage is talking about, we've studied the cherubim and what they are and everything, and Satan, or Lucifer in this passage, is an anointed cherub. Okay, he is not an angel. He tries to appear as an angel of light, but he is not an angel. He is a cherub. He is part one of the cherubim, or was one of the cherubim. He was the anointed cherub that covered. Okay, you remember we've talked about the cherubim and how God's presence is in the midst of the cherubim. And that stones of fire that he's talking about there is in the middle of the cherubim. You remember, who was it? I think it was Isaiah that met right there at the cherubim. And he talked about how he was a man of unclean lips. And one of the cherubim reached in and grabbed one of those stones and put it in his mouth and said, "I've cleansed your lips." You remember that passage? The stones of fire and all that stuff are in the middle of the cherubim. And then we've talked about the holy mountain of God and how that's where God, the mount of the congregation and the sides of the north up there, that's where he sits and resides in his kingdom and does the administrative business of the kingdom, so to speak. You remember Jacob was on the earth and he saw the ladder going up into heaven and the angels descending and ascending. What that's talking about is their point of coming in and out. They were being dispatched from the mount of the congregation, coming down, taking care of their business on the earth, and returning and giving account of themselves. That's why Job 1 talks about how the sons of God come to present themselves before the Lord. That's the place where they come to be judged, to go out and do what needs to be done in the administrative affairs of the universe. When the Bible talks about us judging angels, that's one of the functions that we're going to have. As the body of Christ up in the heavenly places, we're going to be responsible for judging those angels and taking care of that administrative affairs of the government of the universe out there in heaven. So you have Satan was the anointed cherub that covered. God's presence was in the middle of those cherubim. Remember, there were four of them that were joined as one. Two wings joined to the two cherubim on either corner. So you had a cherubim in each corner, and then the wings spread out and became the sides. And then there were wheels, just like a chariot. Talking about the chariot of the Lord. It's what carries his presence around in the universe. Satan was that cherub that covered that vehicle, you might say, of cherubs. He was the one that was on top and over it all. So what you have is a being that God created that was created perfectly, one of the wisest being created, the wisest created being, let's put it that way, who's had an anointed or Christed position that was up above the rest of the creation and covered. You might say he was the top of the tabernacle. Let's put it that way. Remember the tabernacle out in the wilderness? Well, he was the top of the tabernacle. And built in his body was all of those precious stones. Stones that took God's glory that was in the tabernacle there of cherubim and just shot it out. Okay, that's why they say Lucifer's name is Light Bearer. Okay. So here you have him in that anointed position over the top, and he's that light bearer. He's just shooting God's glory out. And involved in that was the tabrets and pipes that were created in him. So obviously music was also involved in the worship when it was created by God. And it was created to be that way when he created Lucifer. Not only so, when he fell... Oh, that's Keith, huh? Okay. That's an odd name for somebody. Anyway. As Satan fell, or Lucifer fell and became Satan, he obviously took his body with him, so he still has that musical capacity in him. And as he fell, obviously music would have fallen with him. Look at verse 15. Thou wast perfect in thy ways from the day that thou wast created till iniquity was found in thee. By the multitude of thy merchandise they have filled the midst of thee with violence, and thou hast sinned. Therefore I will cast thee as profane out of the mountain of God, and I will destroy thee, O covering cherub, from the midst of the stones of fire. Thine heart was lifted up because of thy beauty, Thou hast corrupted thy wisdom by reason of thy brightness. I will cast thee to the ground. I will lay thee before kings, that they may behold thee. Thou hast defiled thy sanctuaries by the multitude of thy iniquities, by the iniquity of thy traffic. Therefore will I bring forth a fire from the midst of thee, it shall devour thee, and I will bring thee to ashes upon the earth in the sight of all them that behold thee, and all they that know thee among the people shall be astonished at thee. There's kind of a progression you see here that happens with Satan. He has that anointed position, he's covering, he's the anointed cherub that covereth, he's covering that tabernacle of the cherubim where God's presence dwells, he's shining that glory out. And he has the musical instruments built into his body to play the music that would lead the universe in the worship of God. But he has a problem. He has a little pride problem. Instead of realizing that the light that he's bearing is God's light and not his own, he's lifted up by reason of his beauty. And that's what causes his downfall. I don't know how much you know about the third heaven, but the third heaven where God dwells, the face of the deep is said to be frozen. And it's like the terrible crystal. In other words, you can get into some scientific stuff here, but when you get outside of time, outside of the deep in the box of the universe, where God inhabits eternity, one of the things that marks time is what? It's the movement of molecules. So when you step outside the box, what happens is the deep, which is water, you remember God when he put the earth in there, or the sun and the moon and all that stuff in there in the firmament, it separated the waters from the waters. So there's water above the earth and water below the earth. So as you go north through the universe up toward the third heaven where God dwells, you go through a huge immense amount of water and then come out up into the third heaven through that terrible crystal or the frozen face of the deep. So if you can kind of picture in your mind the scene up there in the third heaven, you have that chariot of God, so to speak, that tabernacle in which he's dwelling with the wheels and the cherubim that make the body of the thing, and his glory manifested there. You know, it says, he said, let there be light. It's that light, that glory that's manifest in that tabernacle, and Satan was that anointed cherub that covered, shooting that glory out. So what some people conjecture is that Satan looked down at the crystal, which would be like a mirror, and saw his own beauty and the glory of God shooting out through him, and that's what caused him to be lifted up in pride and then to fall. Because what he started to do at that point, according to Ezekiel 28, is to commit his own merchandise and traffic. He started to sell himself. And as he sold himself, he ended up with some sanctuaries, some safe places that belonged to him. In other words, some pockets of his kingdom where he was safe and he was in charge. And this thing spread out and he got filled with violence and God cast him out. Okay? But he was built with that music inside of his body. And that music was something that God created, and it was there for the creation, and no doubt was what the sons of God there, the morning stars, were singing together with in that huge choir that took place when God created the universe. Now, I don't know how much you thought about outer space either. I think about some weird things, but having pipes in your body is not enough. Yes, exactly. Pockets of strongholds. That's the word I was looking for. Strongholds that would belong to him as the creation followed him in the doctrine that he taught. He was out there trafficking with his music and then fell. Go over to 1 Corinthians and look at something kind of... This is David's conjecture. You can take it for what it's worth, but... get 1 Corinthians chapter 2. In outer space, or up in the third heaven, when you have a wind instrument, where did the wind come from? I think about things like that. I used to play clarinet. Well, I still do clarinet and sax and some instruments like that. And, you know, in order to make it work, or a flute or anything else, you have to have wind go through it that creates the tone that you can adjust by the holes to make it play whatever you want. Even in an organ, there's something that moves across the tubes that creates the tone, whether it's steam or electric or whatever it is. But there had to be some air that moved, or some breath that moved through the pipe that caused the instrument to play. Look at 1 Corinthians 14. Get 1 Corinthians 14 and 1 Corinthians 2. Let's look at 1 Corinthians 14 first. Well, let's look at verse 14 and 15. For if I pray in an unknown tongue, my spirit prayeth, but my understanding is unfruitful. What is it then? I will pray with the spirit, and I will pray with the understanding also. I will sing with the spirit, and I will sing with the understanding also. There's some stuff going on there in the Corinthian church. Paul talks about singing with his spirit, but his understanding is not fruitful. He doesn't understand what's going on when he sings with the spirit. So he says, I'll sing with the spirit, and I'll sing with the understanding also. Now watch 1 Corinthians 2. I don't even want to get into what that is. 1 Corinthians 2, look at verse 10. Let's start in verse 9. But as it is written, eye hath not seen, nor ear heard, neither have entered into the heart of man the things which God hath prepared for them that love him. Watch verse 10 and 11. But God hath revealed them unto us by his Spirit. For the Spirit searcheth all things, yea, the deep things of God. For what man knoweth the things of a man, save the spirit of man which is in him? Even so, the things of God knoweth no man, but the Spirit of God. You see how there's kind of a correlation there between the way the Spirit of God works in knowing the things of God and the way the Spirit of man works? Well, if the Spirit of God works within a man the way that the Spirit of God works within God, or that at least in this instance with knowledge in that, and Paul talks about praying with the, or singing with the Spirit and singing with the understanding, then there's a possibility there, putting scripture to scripture there, that what was going on back there was the Spirit of God, who is said to be a breath or a wind, was also with the glory shining through the stones, could have been going through the pipes and providing the music that would have been through Satan's wisdom, Lucifer's wisdom, toned and made into the right pattern to be the song that the angels would then sing. Yeah, there's my conjecture. It would be very interesting if it was God's Spirit. And if you put those two verses together, you can get that idea that that's what it was. But here you have Lucifer, who has that music built in him, and his own wisdom and everything else basically after that was corrupted because of him looking at his own beauty as he was that anointed cherub that covered. And if it was one of us, we would have done the same thing without a doubt. I mean, you have the entire creation staring at you, singing and praying, and they're looking at you when you do it, and you got God's glory shining out of you, and you're the most beautiful thing on the planet, and you're the wisest thing on the planet. It would definitely corrupt you. Satan was lifted up in pride when he saw his beauty, and the same thing happened to him. And as a result of that, music also would have fallen with Satan. So now you have him trafficking and merchandising with his own program and his own music, and then there's God's music in his program. That is the origin of music. It's something that God created, and music is a good thing. And I think we know that by nature. You don't find too many people on the earth that can't stand music, do you? I can't think of one that I've ever met. They like music in some form or other. But Satan, when he fell, probably took that music and then used that music to teach his doctrine that ended up pulling some of the creation away from God the Father so that they fell. And that's the fallen angels that you see in the garden and Satan's demons and devils that you see throughout the rest of the Bible, those fallen gods. Now, music has a purpose. When God created it, obviously, He wanted it to be there, and He created it in the body of Lucifer, and the angels were there singing, and they're God's messengers doing God's work. So they were singing there because God wanted them to sing there, and to joy for joy and worshiping Him and seeing that program that He had going into effect. It also has a purpose for which God created it. Let's look at a few verses here. Go back to Exodus 15, and we'll look at what God's purpose in music is. Obviously, we have the owner's manual here, and God created us a certain way and created things a certain way, and He often lets us know exactly why. Exodus 15. Look at verse 1. Well, let's start in 14. Sorry, Cheryl. Let's start in 14, verse 29. But the children of Israel walked upon dry land in the midst of the sea, and the waters were a wall unto them on their right hand and on their left. Thus the Lord saved Israel that day out of the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead upon the seashore. You know from this verse right here that the interpretation that the scholars like to place about the Sea of Reeds instead of the Red Sea, it's not possible. You have a million plus people walking across on dry land with a wall of water on either side. And Israel saw that great work which the Lord did upon the Egyptians, and the people feared the Lord and believed the Lord and His servant Moses. Chapter 15. Then sang Moses and the children of Israel this song unto the Lord, and spake, saying, I will sing unto the Lord, for He hath triumphed gloriously. The horse and his rider hath He thrown into the sea. The Lord is my strength and song. He has become my salvation. He is my God, and I will prepare Him an habitation. My father's God, and I will exalt Him. The Lord is a man of war. The Lord is His name. And he goes through here, and he teaches a bunch of information inside of this song. One of the informations that he sings there is that the Lord is a man of war and that he's Israel's God. But there's some other information in there. When they sing this song, you're getting information in that song. Look at Numbers 21. Yeah, we're going to go a little bit late today. Numbers 21. Let's start in verse. Here's another big event in Israel's history. Let's start in verse 12. From thence they removed and pitched in the valley of Zered. From thence they removed and pitched on the other side of Arnon, which is in the wilderness that cometh out of the coast of the Amorites. For Arnon is the border of Moab, between Moab and the Amorites. Wherefore it is said in the book of the wars of the Lord, what He did in the Red Sea, and in the brooks of Arnon, and at the stream of the brooks that goeth down to the dwelling of Ar, and lieth upon the border of Moab. A big event took place. And from thence they went to Beer, that is the well whereof the Lord spake unto Moses, gather the people together, and I will give them water. So they get water again after this big event and this war and everything that took place. In verse 17, here's what Israel does. Then Israel sang this song. Spring up, O well, sing ye unto it. The princes dig the well. The nobles of the people digged it by the direction of the lawgiver with their staves. And from the wilderness they went to Mantena. And from Mantena, and you know, they go on in their journey. But they have this big event and they come back to this place where God gave Israel water. And they have a song that goes with it. And in the song, they teach some things. Look at Deuteronomy 31. Start in verse 15. Yeah, I'll start in verse 15. And the Lord appeared in the tabernacle in a pillar of a cloud, and the pillar of the cloud stood over the door of the tabernacle. And the Lord said unto Moses, behold, thou shalt sleep with thy fathers, and this people will rise up and go whoring after the gods of the strangers of the land, whither they go to be among them, and will forsake me and break my covenant which I have made with them. Then my anger shall be kindled against them in that day, and I will forsake them, and I will hide my face from them, and they shall be devoured, and many evils and troubles shall befall them, so that they will say in that day, Are not these evils come upon us because our God is not among us? And I will surely hide my face in that day for all the evils which they shall have wrought, in that they are turned unto other gods. And we've looked at that. We've talked about how the fact that that's a passage that looks at the tribulation period. Hang on a sec. Let's continue on. He's going to hide his face from them in that day for all the evils which they have wrought because of their idolatry. Verse 19. Now therefore, because of this, write ye this song for you, and teach it the children of Israel, and put it in their mouths, that this song may be a witness for me against the children of Israel. For when I shall have brought them into the land which I swore unto their fathers, that floweth with milk and honey, and they shall have eaten and filled themselves and waxen fat, then they will turn unto other gods and serve them, and provoke me, and break my covenant. And it shall come to pass when many evils and troubles are befallen them, that this song shall testify against them as a witness, for it shall not be forgotten out of the mouths of their seed. For I know their imagination which they go about even now, before I brought them into the land which I swear. Moses therefore wrote this song the same day and taught it to the children of Israel. Look at verse 30. And Moses spake in the ears of all the congregation of Israel the words of this song until they were ended. And chapter 32 is that song. Give ear, O heavens, and I will speak, and hear, O earth, the words of my mouth. My doctrine shall drop as the rain, my speech shall distill as the dew, as the small rain upon the tender herb, and as the showers upon the grass, because I will publish the name of the Lord. Ascribe ye greatness unto our God. He is the rock, his work is perfect, for all his ways are judgment. A God of truth and without iniquity, just and right is he. They have corrupted themselves. Their spot is not the spot of his children. They are a perverse and crooked generation. You know, any time in nations in Israel's history when they're going to be looking at having to take a spot, or you might say mark, this passage all goes over to that time. And it's possible that this is one of the songs that they're going to sing out in the wilderness when God calls them out in the wilderness and speaks to them. But you see what he says, he because of what they're going to do, because they're going to get fat, and then they're going to turn away from him and turn to idolatry, he teaches this song and says, my doctrine's going to drop as the rain. With these three passages, what they're talking about is, there are songs being sung with the purpose of teaching doctrine. What God is doing when he created song, was he created song for the purpose of carrying something to give to someone. And what he designed it to carry was doctrine. The song carried a message that God had to give. And that was the purpose of music. Matter of fact, let's look at Psalm 40. Get Psalm 40. Psalm 40. Look at verse 3. And he hath put a new song in my mouth, even praise unto our God. Many shall see it and fear and shall trust in the Lord. Blessed is that man that maketh the Lord his trust and respecteth not the proud, nor such as turn aside to lies. Now if God put a new song in his mouth that was praise, and the result of it was that many would see it and fear and trust in the Lord instead of lies, what was the song teaching? The song was teaching truth, wasn't it? So God designed a song, put it in his mouth, to praise him and to teach truth. Look at Psalm 89. Psalm 89, verse 1. I will sing of the mercies of the Lord forever with my mouth. Will I make known thy faithfulness to all generations. For I have said, mercy shall be built up forever, thy faithfulness shalt thou establish in the very heavens. And you go on and on. He's going to sing of the mercies of the Lord forever. With his mouth, he's going to make known his faithfulness to all generations. What is he doing? He's singing songs and teaching doctrine about God. That's the purpose for which God created music. Here's a good example. Advertisers know this better than anyone, because the bottom line for them is money. So what they want to do is they want to get their doctrine across to you in such a way that you're not going to forget the doctrine that they want you to hear. You ever hear this song? I bet every one of you know the words to that song. It's Oscar Mayer. My Baloney has a first name. It's O-S-C-A-R, okay? I mean, you know that, Diddy. Why do you know it? Because the advertisers put the information in the music in such a way that you would get their doctrine and it would stick with you, so that you would do what? Buy their product. You want to run out of the store and buy Oscar Mayer bologna. Hot dogs, yeah, sure they do. The advertisers know that because what they worry about is what works. And God said what works in His Word, and they just happen to match that by experience so that they sell the greatest amount of things by using those little ditties. Okay. My bologna has a first name. Anyway, I guess we better stop there because we got a lot more to go, and we're definitely not going to finish it tonight. But the origin of music was something that God Himself created and intended for it to be there, and He had a purpose in it. And the purpose which He had for it was to teach doctrine, to praise Him and teach doctrine, teach about who He is and what He's doing. Next week, we're going to look at how music has been corrupted. We're going to look at how God has a redemption program even for music, and how He's going to we'll start at the sandwich. We'll see how God is going to restore music. And then we'll look at how music is made up to understand, by looking at the different parts of music, how we can find the music that's right, that's God-honoring, it's godly music, so that we can listen to that music, so that the doctrine then that's being built up in our soul is the right doctrine. Any questions?